Good morning. It is the 21st of November. It's a Thursday. That can only mean one thing. It means it's time for The Burning Platform with none other than the delightful, the delicious, the undefeated Pumi Mashiko and I. And here's Pums. And good morning, everybody. I see the comment section.
Good morning.
Comment section alive and well already. I see everything going here. Stream connection check, right, mics check, video check. Clear. Full liftoff. Says propaganda.
Are we clear for takeoff?
Yeah.
Are we clear for takeoff?
So Snae says, Gareth, I've dubbed Sis Pumi our internal mama mprofeti because she has accurately predicted a lot of the shit that we see going down in the EFF. Well, it's funny you mention that, and I'm going to introduce our guest in a second, but Pumi wants to start off with like a very quick year in review. Like 2024 is definitely not under-delivered in terms of excitement and craziness and wow factor and all of that stuff. But let's introduce our guest because I also want to hear his thoughts on this. 2024 is the year of madness, and that would mean that we haven't checked in with this man enough because he's actually a sanity check for us. But here he is. Lieto, who has been on the show so many, many times. It's a great pleasure to see you on the show again, sir. I see the dreadlocks are gone, which Pumi and I are both very upset about. How's 2024 been for you?
Dreadlocks are gone. That's how it's been.
No, they're gone. We're growing older. But I think, 2024 for me has been quite almost uneventful, eh?
No.
I needed something more. Nuclear bomb needed, you know, assassination. Successful assassination.
It's not over yet. There have been a couple of successful assassinations, sir.
And let me tell I think your problem is you've got to get out of Velkom. Obviously, nothing will happen there.
you don't even know the half of it. Since last we spoke, our mayor got arrested.
Oh,
and is going to serve, I think, a year and a half in jail. Guess why?
Arrested and is going to serve. That's insane. Yeah. For what?
No, please guess. I'm taking guesses.
letting the water system down.
No, okay. It won't be something to do with his actual job. It'll be like he's molested a child or he's committed some sex act against another person in the municipality. It's not to do with his job, because they'll never fire someone for that.
Yes. So Gareth's right? On the right track.
Something to do with his penis.
No. Now you're losing it again. Okay. He beat up one of his protectors.
Yes. You guys have got rough people. You know, Leto, we used to joke because I haven't been to Velkom for years, but I went there once ages ago, and I think you even said you were there. I mean, I went to DJ. This is back in the day. And I've never been told that there's got to be someone who goes with you through this club. And they gave me this Congolese man who was broader than he was tall, all right? And I said, why are you doing this, guys? I mean, like, I've never had protection in a club before. I'm there because people hopefully want to see me. We're having fun. There's music. There's drinking. They said, this is Velkom. And it seems like Velkom lives up to its reputation as being just a place where violence is actually entertainment.
It actually does. Like, we're like five strange cars from being in a Mad Max movie. Like, the mall that was in the center of town, like in the center of town, the mall has been vandalized, and people are now taking the roof, the corrugated iron off the roof, to go make shacks in the township, like in front of police. Like, yes. we're there right now. Like, people are vandalizing a building, and police are holding hands and watching.
Okay, slow your roll. Sheesh, that is so many hectic things, but. You know, one of the reasons we were talking about you and we thought you would be a fantastic person to bring onto the show today is because, Lieto, you've been warning us about Zamazamas. You have been SoundCloud. You were the first person who said to all of us, there's chaos down the line. And if nobody does anything and nobody is looking, this is going to be a big problem. And I think in the past 3 weeks, we're all watching from, I feel like, you know, those people on social media that say, kunining iti yo. Every time.
A lot.
There's a new news bulletin. And there is an update about what is happening in Stilfontein. I am going from gobsmacked to gobsmacked. And you have warned us about this. So I thought, let's talk to Lieto and see what he thinks. Watching from one mining town that has been completely taken over by Zama Zamas, how it is being dealt with in Stilfontein. What's your thoughts? What do you think?
So the reason why I knew this was coming, I think from 2 or 3 years back, if not 5 years back, they had their Pablo Escobar moment. Actually, illegal mining in South Africa has always been very organized and very cartelled. I couldn't now suddenly go and try to be an illegal miner. There was a way in which I had to have a boss who I had to report to. He gave me a minimum amount of gold I need to bring out in order to bring some out for myself. And so it was like a sort of independent contractor kind of deal. And then I think the trouble started when they stopped taking boys from the township, like in towns like Stilfontein, like Welkom, and started bringing in the guys from Lesotho, right? Mm-hmm. Initially, it was fine, right? With the guys from Lesotho, they didn't even understand that independent contractor sort of more method that people were using. All you had to do was to help them send clothes back in December and buy a couple of bricks and corrugated iron so that they could extend the house in Lesotho. And so you never had to actually give them a lot of money until the people from Lesotho wised up to the fact that you can go at it by yourself. There was violence before the leaders got arrested in Welkom. And once the leaders here got arrested and the sort of circle sort of got smaller, and they made laws to make it very hard to become an illegal miner in and around Welkom. Now what happened was all of these guys from Lesotho moved towards the Vaal Triangle, towards the Northwest, in all of those places, and then tried to set up shop there. The same thing is going to happen in Carltonville. Watch that space. It's going to start getting a whole lot more violent and a whole lot more disorganized. And so this was a trend that was coming. And along with even though we like to dunk on the government and how porous our borders are, the enforcement that they're putting on the borders is now also paying back, because the gold that is mined actually has to go through, well, is usually going through the Northwest border. And that's why it was always so convenient for them to set up in places like Stilfontein, because the Northwest border was the most porous into Botswana, and then going through Zimbabwe to Mozambique, that's where the gold would end up. So it's either you had two routes. From Welkom, you'd go straight to Mozambique, or you'd go to the Northwest into Botswana. And so now those routes are harder to traverse, it's harder to bribe people at those posts because there are more people and more eyes. It's getting desperate for people who are in it for themselves, by the way.
Hectic. And what do you think, just watching what's happening from a person who is sitting in a town that's gone through all these iterations, as you explain, when you see how it's unfolding in Stilfontein, a court case has been brought by an NGO called Society for the Protection of Our Constitution, or something of that sort. I have been looking for this NGO. I can't find anything about them anywhere. I can't even find a landing page website. So a court case has been brought against the police. This embargo with the police standing at the entrances and refusing to let anything in or out, unless it's a person going into the back of a van. And now the community up in arms, fighting the police about this blockade. What do you make of all of that? you know, watching.
The problem is the illegal mining is not the illegal mining. And this is what many people don't understand. Their whole economy is connected to the illegal mining, right? So when if I'm an illegal miner, I go underground, right? I don't have the luxury of coming back up to go get food. I don't have the luxury of coming up to get entertainment. And so they stay there for 6 to 8 months at a time, right? The reason why the community is up in arms is that they benefit from such things. So when illegal miners come out of the mine, by the way, they only have to come out at night because, like, when you now are done illegal mining, let's assume you've gotten your minimum and you got your gold and you're good. You can only come out at night because the sun hurts your eyes. You can go blind because you've been in the dark. You've been in the dark for 8 months. What? Yes. And so what happens is...
Can I just pause you for a second? Like, tell us what else happens to people when they've been underground for 8 months. I mean, this is not normal. This is very, very bad for you from a health point of view. What are the conditions like down there? I mean, I don't want to sound like the South African Human Rights Commission, who are a joke, because they should be investigating this kind of thing. But honest to God, this is probably the most disgusting way for a human being to exist. I don't think there are very many things in the world, even in a Chinese factory where you start at age 6 or whatever. I don't think it's as bad as being underground, shitting and eating in the same place, no light, no fresh air. Just explain what goes on down there, Leto, because before we get on to criticizing this one and finding out whether that one's responsible to NGO that Pumi's talking about, which I'm interested in, and by the way, I can almost guarantee is funded by some international money person who doesn't want to be known. That's always how it works, right? It's always foreign money coming in to interfere in our stuff through an NGO. But tell me about these people and their lives.
So when you're down there, one, don't die, because they're not going to bring your body up. They're going to throw you down the shaft. And because the end of the mine shaft at the bottom, where the catch doesn't go, is basically a half-flooded soup of nothingness. They go to the edge to pee down there, to go and defecate down there. They throw the dead bodies down there, especially those who are murdered underground, right? Don't sleep too tightly. You might be inhaling methane and you just die because it's almost odorless and it's hard to detect when you're down there, right? When you come out, you have to come out at night. But also, when you come out, we have to negotiate with the security guards in order to go and get you. Your skin is almost peeling off because it's not had contact with the sun. So when you come out, you actually have to have a landing area. Because remember, if you are renting a room or you're doing something, you are susceptible to the stick-up boys in the township. So if you go out, we have to black out your windows so that the sun doesn't come in. We have to introduce you to the sun gradually for like a month and a half. And so that's when people can come. The police can come and rob you. The sticker boys in the township can come and rob you. And so the community members then benefit, will come to you, Gareth, and say, Gareth, please, how's our guy? He can't see, he can't move. We'll give you 200,000 rand, right? And so that's how the community makes its way in. But on the other hand, there's also another economy, the food economy down there, right? And because it's so hard, but also food is so scarce, I remember they were talking about, like, so in Welkom, one of the big examples that they were making was apparently illegal miners love Nando's for some reason. And so if you were able to buy 50 full Nando's chickens for them, they'd give you R1 million, right? But the biggest problem, now in Welkom, you can't go and buy more than 5 chickens for yourself. If you go and say, can I have 5 full chickens? You'll start to see the police come. So you have to answer for that. You can't buy a pallet of tin food. So Lucky Starfish, all of those, you can't buy those because that's how they got food to them, even alcohol. So if, I remember a cider, they put a cider and a beer together, and they sort of, and another thing they used to love, CNA was rich because of them, they used to love masking tape, is the one thing that they use the most. So they put these things together so they can push them underground. and then to get their money back, right? So a cider and a beer is 150 rand for one cider, one beer. That combination is 150 rand. A full loaf of bread, 360 rand. Two cans or a can of Lucky Star fish and beans, I think is 400 rand. And so there are prices that are hyperinflated. So if you were willing to risk your life to get that, you will get the rewards as a member of the community. There are people who are responsible for getting them, like movies and pornography. So if you can find like these little MP4 players with the little screens, they'll tell you we need 80 orders of those. Just fill them up with pornography, fill them up with music, fill them up with movies and series, and you're probably going to get yourself 900,000 to around about 2 million rand, depending on how many people
you're astronomical. These numbers you are saying are insane, right? So 350 for a loaf of bread, and all presumably a cash economy?
Yes, all cash. In places where there's illegal mining, you can't go to an ATM and withdraw a 200 rand note. It's only recently in Welkom that the ATM has started to dispense 200 rand notes.
And raw gold?
So raw gold you actually never see. They actually make sure that they don't get caught with raw gold, because raw gold is definitive, right? Mm-hmm. Once you see gold, you know it's gold. So they keep it in its unprocessed form for as long as possible. Because once they get arrested, there are lawyers who make their living here, cash lawyers, who make their living disputing those cases. And so they'll want a metallurgical test and ask. So they'll ask a police officer straight up and say, so how did you know what he had was gold? You don't have some kind of testing mechanism. So how did you know initially when you caught him that what the bag of sand? Because gold looks like shiny sand, the way that they are mining it. It's like a bag of shiny sand. And so they say, so how did you know this was gold, right? And so it's crazy. I was telling Tanganisi the other day, a friend of ours, that there's also another economy linked to this. The illegal, the male enhancement pills, right? Mm-hmm. So what happens is they can't refine the gold with the normal chemicals that are refined. So they refine it with mercury. Of the guys who are refining the gold have mercury poisoning, and so they have erectile dysfunction. First thing to go when you have heavy metal poisoning is that. And so now there's also an economy.
By the way, the other thing that happens when you have mercury in your system and there's a lot of mercury around you and you use it in your hands and so on, which is what they do, is you go mad. You know, the statement "mad as a hatter" comes from hatters, people who used to make headwear in Britain, and they used to use mercury to straighten out the leather or the fabric, and they actually went crazy. So a lot of these people actually go completely crazy because of the mercury, which would also explain like the violence. It will explain some.
They'll murder their whole families at times, and all of that. You find the strange stories. You find a husband with their wife in the fridge, chopped up. All of those strange things. And so now there's this illegal market of male enhancement pills that come from the Indias, Bangladesh, Pakistan, those areas. And so there's so many aspects to it that in order for you to actually deal with illegal mining, the guys in the hole are actually the last. They're the people who actually suffer most. You must look at the auxiliary economies around that hole, and then suddenly you start to see the whole picture.
You know, it's amazing how we have these ancillary and auxiliary economies in this country, and people will find a way. Hey, I mean, this. Just imagine if you were the first person to figure out that you could get 50 Nando's chickens and make a million rand.
Huh? No, that's why you come to Welkom and see a Ferrari. There's some things that don't make sense. In the middle of the day, you'll see a Ferrari, Lamborghini. There was a guy who had a G-Wagon. It was customized from Germany. But you've never seen this guy go to work.
Well, or is there enough economy? You know, you're kind of going, where does this guy work? Is there enough economy? But what I'm also interested to know is then, how does that distort what the living and inflation for other people, right? So if Nando's can, if somebody can buy out the Nando's store because they're going to get R1 million or whatever, then other people don't have access to Nando's. Like you were saying, the ATMs weren't dispensing the R200 notes and all of that. How does that then distort life for the people who are not part of this economy or economic activity? Or is everybody part of the activity, Leto?
No, the town is dying anyway. So we don't notice when all of the chicken is bought out at Nando's, because we all go to Nando's at the end of the month, and in the middle of the month, the Nando's is actually suffering, right? And so the owners of these places would also incentivize such activities, right? And so you find that they're very intelligent, these guys. They'll create security companies. So their security company will go and run interference on the mine security company, because actually, as well, on the other side, what could be defined as a mine is very loose, because the mining charter is this basically self-governing thing that the that the mining companies have and the mining bosses have amongst themselves. Is that so? What constitutes a mine is that you, if you have two shifts of 20 people, a mine manager, two assistants, and a surveyor or something like that, then technically the mine still works. And so all you have to do is to not revive, or is not to rehabilitate the grounds of where the mine is. And so so all you, then what you can do is to just be, because if you look at Stilfontein, where the illegal miners are going in, it's not actually where the mine is. Did you notice that it's just a felt with a big block of cement in the ground that was broken, and now they went in, right? So what happens is when they sink a shaft, or when they start out a mine, is that they, when you start working, you work progressively from the one side, which is going to be the formal side where everybody comes into with the catch, what the lift is. On the other side, you have to dig an exit in case there's a cave in behind you. So they call that Madala side, right? And that side of the mine is usually unguarded, closer to the community, and it's the escape hatch in case of a cave-in. And so what happens is, when the mine starts to tone down its operations, all they do is they shut the Madala side, right? And that's why there's always an emergency suddenly when there's a cave-in, because the place where the people are supposed to escape has been closed by the mine intentionally, because they have scaled down operations. So what the illegal miners just do is come in and break the cement and go in. But what is actually supposed to happen, according to the laws in South Africa, is that once a mine is no longer fully operational, you're supposed to close it down and rehabilitate the land. Meaning, if you've taken out 100 metric tons of material from within the earth, you have to put back 100 metric tons of material in the earth. And you can't put back what you took out. Because when you took out what is in the slime dam and also what's in the mound, it's now small rocks and pebbles. If you put back those rocks and pebbles into the ground, they'll increase the seismic activity. So you have to replace it with something stable. So you have to fill the shaft with cement and other things so that now you stabilize the ground under you. But all of that costs billions of rands, which the mine bosses and the shareholders aren't willing to do. They're more than happy to pay 2 million rand a year to this mine manager and his 60 people that go to work, instead of trying to rehabilitate the mine. And so those are the dynamics.
Sure. That is... For me, even though I live in Joburg, and you would think we're a mining town, right? I would know these kinds of things. It's a fascinating story to hear. And I'm then wondering about the skill, right? The skills of the people who go underground and who who though you said earlier that when they stopped bringing in kids from the township who were unemployed young people, but not necessarily people who have mining experience, having worked in the mines, and replacing them with guys from Lesotho who do have mine experience, because that's what the entire mining economy of South Africa was built on, labor from labor sending areas like Lesotho, like the Eastern Cape, like Malawi. So now that's who's going underground there. And as mines close down and mines close down, there's the skill in the market because they're not working. So I'm also wondering how other people can participate, or do they participate? Or they, you know, people are just like standing by watching foreign nationals coming into their communities and taking over, essentially.
Well, it's a bit strange. So, like I said, these guys are really smart. They figured out the same thing that the mines do. Is that even though I'm an amateur when it comes to mining, if I have three shift bosses who are really, really good at mining, they can teach me the safety, they can teach me how to do it, they can teach me how to find gold in the dark, they can teach me all of these things. And so that's all they did. They have a general in there who is a good, experienced miner. He gets more than all the others, of course, but he teaches them how to find the gold, how to seek it out, and how to sort of bundle it while they're down there, right? He's responsible for the loot, basically. But here's the other part about it. So when you're thinking about it, you don't have the, like, people, it's not just, oh, foreign nationals are just coming to take our gold and let's just stand on the side. Everyone is involved in some kind of way, right? I had a guy who lived down the street from me. I was raised in his house. He was an older gentleman. He's passed away now, but he was one of the stick-up boys. And this is what they did. There were eight of them, and they would wait for people to come back from the mines. They look out for blackout windows. For blackout windows, they'll come into your house with hammers and torture you until you give them the money. So they make money, and nobody's going to go and complain to the police because one of them is a police officer. So you can't, you've gone there for 8 months, you've gotten your gold, you've now been robbed, you must just now take the L and try and go back another day when you're healthy so that you can make another go at it. I remember in Welkom, I think it was 3 years ago, when the whole crackdown happened, it wasn't just the illegal mining bosses who got arrested, but a bunch of police officers were taken off the force when they looked at their lifestyle. They did a semi-lifestyle audit. Most of the officers in Welkom were not even withdrawing their own money, that they were left with millions in the bank, because all they did was patrol the areas where the illegal miners were, catch them because they know they always have tons of cash with them. So the police officers don't care about the gold because they can't process it and move it like the illegal miners can. But imagine you are an officer, it's the 18th of the month, right? Your wife is on you, you need to pay this debt and that debt and the car and this. And somebody says to you, well, officer, you're arresting me. I have a bag full of 500,000 rand here. It was supposed to be for my food, but I didn't buy with all of it. You can have it. Let me go. What decision are you making, even if you are the best cop in town? You're going to take the money. And they would make dockets disappear. And they were, I'm telling you, like, even the legal side of this thing, there are lawyers in Welkom. If you go and you say, hey, listen, I have an assault case, they say, no, I don't do assault. Do gold mining.
That's why the mayor got a year and a half.
Yeah. If you're arrested with gold, if you're arrested with copper, I do minerals. That's what the lawyer will tell you. Because he knows that these guys, one, they're illiterate, and they'll pay cash. And the amount of money that they have, they're not afraid to come to you and say, right now I'm caught. My wife is bringing to you 500,000 rand cash. I don't know how long that will last, but get me out of prison. And so the lawyer has a cop on the line, says, no, here's 100,000 rand. Change the dates on the docket. You understand? If you change the dates on my docket, the case is invalid.
Yeah.
Jeez. You know what? But just hearing you talk about all of this stuff, I'm also wondering, and I'm thinking about all the TikToks that we see. Right? So obviously now it's at the top of the algorithm, all the TikToks with the guys with the guns and the money, the stacks and stacks of cash and singing and dancing and all of that. And I'm wondering, as I watch what's unfolding at Stilfontein, there's a big contingent of police waiting at the entrances to these mining operations. Are they part of the system too? You know, how do you break the back of this thing? You know, you're talking about the raids that happened in Velkom and Velkom kind of beginning to normalize. How do you break the back of something that seems so well established with so many players and so many people with so much to lose?
The police that are there in Stilfontein are also compensating, right? That's why the community members are so outraged. They'll point at the cop and say, but you, Lieto, we know you, right? Because that's how it all goes. And so what you have to do is to have these almost strange-looking laws, if you think about it, right? But that secure less and less economy moving or less and less goods moving towards that whole to support those illegal miners. So the first thing is cutting the food supply line, right? So now in Velkom, you can't go and buy pellets of like I said, tinned food, right? Unless you have a VAT vendor certificate. You have to be somebody who owns...
Oh, really?
Yes. You can't go and buy 50 chickens at Nando's anymore. They have to call the police if you buy more than five. Because now what had happened was they'd come and buy five at a time. Me and my sisters would just come buy five at a time until we have 50, right? And so that's the next thing. The other thing is looking for suspicious houses in quiet, lush neighborhoods. Especially now they look at people with debt. So they'll approach you and say to you, Sipumi, we see you owe your house. We can come in and give you $1 million. We just want to package the food here for two or three cycles and you'll be out of debt. And so they look for all of those things. Oh. And once you start to find those small little things and how the economy around the mine works, it gets harder for somebody to be in the mine for 6 to 7 months at a go. You go and you find the one tavern that sells beers for 10 rand a pop, even in this economy, because that guy is clearly washing money. The tuck shop that's always full of things and nobody ever buys at. The society schemes that come from inside the community. How are they funded? And so once you start to see all of that money, you'll get to detect one, where the big players are. Because what they're doing now is superficial. If they get to court, I've been asking the same question all week long. If you take the guys from Stilfontein right now as they are, and you take them out of the hole, put them in the van, and put them at the police station, what are you going to charge them with? The only thing they can charge them with, we all know in Belgium, we are laughing at it, the only thing that they're going to charge them with is trespassing. Because you didn't find them with anything. They're not coming out with bags of gold. You're going to take them out, charge them with trespassing, slap on the wrist, back in the community.
Sure. It's unbelievable.
So, is it solvable?
It is solvable. So I was helping, for instance, I'm helping a bunch of young people now in Velkom. They are trying to create a collective of artisanal miners, which is allowed under the law, but we had to dig, we had to write proposals, and we're now approaching the derelict mines, right? And it seems like the mine managers are really open to that suggestion because people can make a living. Because gold is really, it makes people make a really good living off of gold.
So take a step back, Lieto, and I think a lot of people have heard this term artisanal miners, but I don't know if we all understand the same thing about it. What does that mean? What is artisanal mine? What's the difference between an artisanal miner and a zama-zama? What is the difference?
The law says artisanal miners are miners that mine without any sophisticated equipment. So if me and Gareth decide to get steel pans and go stand in a river and start to pan the river, we'll find little nuggets of gold there, right? Which is the natural progression. Water cycles gold out of the ground. And so you can pan for gold. If you're panning for gold, you're artisanal mining because you are not large-scale, sophisticated equipment mining, right? And so, and that's why there's a very thin line, because that's what an illegal miner is doing anyway.
Yes. Right?
They're just going underground in this mine. But then the first charge is the trespassing charge. That's why they have guns. It started to become a problem because as an illegal miner, you don't make it off of the mining grounds anymore because of the overly aggressive security companies. You come out of the hole, they shoot you in the head because you're just going to be charged with trespassing. You come out of the hole, luckily there are police there, you give them 100,000 rand, you're on your way home. And so it then started to become a very violent interaction between the security companies and the illegal miners themselves. So what we are looking at these young people to say, since the mine is not going to close, it's not going to be rehabilitated, can the young people make a living, some kind of living, attaching themselves to this derelict mine? Because what used to happen before, a mine had two shifts, an afternoon shift and a night shift. And that's a healthy mine, right? So the night shifts are gone because the mine is not as productive. It's not it's not bringing out the high yield gold. By the way, South African gold is 90 percentile, right? It's 90th percentile. It's very, very rich gold. The mine will start to draw back operations once the gold is at 60% quality and it's mixed in with brass and whatever, because it takes a lot more energy to process it. And so when it's at 50 to 40%, then the mine is non-operational. But if you are a young person who's going to get 80 grams of that, 3 kilograms, 4 kilograms, that's in a year, you're almost making 6-7 million rand if you're doing that a month. So it's good money for a civilian because you don't look at the economics. All you're trying to do is to extract the gold. And so that's what these young artisanal miners are trying to do.
But who's the market?
In recognition.
Who do they sell to? Who do they sell to, and how do they find those people?
No, so now the artisanal miners, the agreement we're making is they sell back to the mine for refining, right? Because also it's illegal to refine your own gold in South Africa. So even if you find it, refining is also a legal sort of mark that you can't get through as a civilian. Somewhere you're gonna mess up and you're gonna get arrested because possession of mercury illegal in certain quantities, possession of one of the chemicals, I forget which one it is also illegal in certain quantities. So all of those are traps for them. So what we're trying to do is to say, we'll take out the materials, you weigh it out for us, you refine it for us, and then you tell us how much we've earned from that. You can buy it from us. And so even if it's not going to be the huge amounts that the illegal miners make, you know, somebody is now not a criminal, is not breaking the law, is not at risk of getting arrested, but is feeding their family through what should be stuff under their feet.
Sure.
Okay, so let's get back to this thing at Stilfontein, because I think this is fascinating to everybody just because of the sheer scale of the thing, all right? You predicted this a long time ago. Thomas Sowell says there's no such thing as a solution. There are only trade-offs. What do you think is the best possible way to resolve this issue? There are going to be losers. There are going to be winners. The minister in the presidency has said that she wants to smoke them out. She doesn't care how many are there. Clearly, if they are illegal, she wants them thrown into what do they call them? Repatriation centers, essentially concentration camps. There's some very hardliners who back her and say, yeah, it's time to clean this illegal mining thing up. And there are other people who say, oh, no, but the human rights, and we've got to care about these people. And, you know, even though they're underground and it's terrible, they're still people. What do you think?
So I think Minister and the President Tshabeni just heard the strategy, right? Because that's what they did in Velcom. They smoked them out, right? Mm. And then she used it very crudely. It's a strategy that you have to employ to get the people to stop going to the hole, right? It gets more and more dangerous going there. On the other side, you're going to take them to repatriation centers, and then what? You're going to take the guys back to Lesotho.
Yeah, exactly.
Within 6 hours, they are back in Bethlehem because they can literally walk there. So let's stop all of that tough talk, right? What we need to do, because this kind of thing, and people are just going to try and dig up whatever is there anyway, right? So, by the way, one of the things that's happening in Velcom now is that, right, ever since the illegal miners have stopped going in, there are companies that create different kind of steel trap doors, and like to see whether or not illegal miners have gone in, they have different kind of latches and all of these nice technologies. But at the end of it, how do you guarantee that people eat from all of this, right? And so you have to then create an avenue for people to start making money. Because remember, there's one guy who was making money just from going to Checkers, buying 30 loaves of bread and then selling them for 350 a pop to these guys. And so that guy is not an illegal miner. Now you've made another poor person. Yeah. And so it's going to be, there's no one like one blanket solution, right? And that's why I'm trying to help these guys with their artisanal mining proposals. I think that's one of the ways in which you can alleviate some of the poverty that young South Africans feel by creating a lane for them to make money. On the other hand, it's also linked deeply to the migration and the porous borders of South Africa. If you're going to tell me you are going to get the guys from Lesotho out somehow, Mabahambe, it's not going to happen. Because the guys from Lesotho, literally, you deport them, 3-4 hours later, they are back in South Africa because they live in some part of the border where nobody patrols, where they literally they can see South Africa from across where they are. It's like crossing the street. There's right. No fence, there's no anything. And so we must also try to understand the dynamics that bring those from Lesotho here, but also trying to make them, or trying to mitigate the violence. Velcom has not seen the levels of violence that Stilfontein has seen, and the levels of violence that are rising in places like Carletonville, because even though the police are corrupt, they were still policing them. If you had a gun, doesn't matter if you had 500,000 rand on you, you're being taken in. South African the Velcom police were very overzealous about guns and prosecuting people with guns. And so even though they are corrupt, they were still doing their job to the degree that the harm is mitigated. And all that happens is a lot of money gets traded and banded about. And I think nobody in Velcom was feeling, you know, sad by the fact that some police officer ripped off some illegal miner.
I see Snaya's comment here. I'm in the financial compliance regulatory space, and gold is very problematic for us because it's used to commit crimes like money laundering and terror financing. I'm down for anything that combats illegal mining.
Mm. Yep. And it's hard. Like, once that money gets to Mozambique, you start to see, because you're asking yourself, how is the insurgents in Mozambique in a 500,000 rand car? How is that happening? How are they getting all these Toyota buggies? And somebody will say, oh, no, it's the hijacking in South Africa. No, part of it is the gold that comes from illegal mining, because it's much easier, right? And just like I said, it's also much easier just to carry around a bunch of 200 rand notes. Once I get into a club and I see a guy with a roll of 200 rand notes, in Velcom, we already knew. We'd poke each other and say, we know it comes from the hole. Right? Mm-hmm. And that's it. And so it's going to be very hard for us to find a real tangible solution, because the greed for the gold, but also the desperation from those who go and get the gold, it outweighs whatever punishment you give to them. Because the arrests of people who are illegal mining is always very funny. If you go to any courthouse in a place that's got illegal mining, you find the funniest stories. I remember one of the stories was it was six guys from Lesotho. They got arrested with this gold dust. And when the exhibits were presented in court, the one guy was like, no, I was illegal mining, right? I was caught, but they caught me with a blue plastic, and that plastic had 10 kilograms. Here are white and black plastics, and none of them are 10 kilograms. I'm not going to jail for something I didn't do. These are not mine. I want my plastic. Bring it here, and I'll go to jail.
That's insane. Well, but it's a defense. It's a defense. Speaking of defenses, what do you make of the involvement of NGOs like the Society for the Defense of Our Constitution, NGOs who then essentially come in, this particular one, in my view, has come in and is, I don't know if from a place, from a good place, I doubt it very much, but very determined to fight the law enforcement, very determined to fight government's efforts in this particular environment. What do you make of these types of NGOs and the work that they do?
Like Gareth said, it's always foreign money coming in to our problems, right? Because once we get our eyes off of the poor black people in a dark hole who are being smoked out, the next question is, but who owns this place? And why is it still open like that? And why can people just readily go in? And then we get to the money of the problem, right? That somebody, it's somebody's job to close that mine properly and to make sure that it's closed. And I'm telling you, it's billions of rand to rehabilitate a mine, especially a gold mine, because these people have dug deep, have done a lot of shady things down there that now to cover and rehabilitate the land will create a whole new economy, by the way, in order for you to start doing the right thing. And so those NGOs are literally the people who are there to fight for their own heads and try to run interference. You find them everywhere, right? And they'll come and they'll ambulance chase. I remember here, they used to go in and threaten the sole mine manager who's left there to look after the mine. And they would force them to have safety officers. Because remember, the mine is basically shut down, so you don't need the whole safety contingent. But they forced them to court to have safety contingents to send down there to go and get illegal miners who are in trouble. And that was happening for a very long time, that illegal miners who were in trouble underground would call the mine at the surface and say, guys, you can't get out now, we are stuck, help. And they would get help. And so all of these are mechanisms to get to where the real money is. The people who actually got to benefit from the fact that there's gold in South Africa, who don't live here, who are elsewhere, but are now liable for those mines. Because even though the mining charter is strange in how it's enforced, it still is very explicit about liability and who's liable for mines that are unrehabilitated. And so I think those NGOs will come and try to run interference because the due diligence is not done on the closure of mines. And by the way, when it was Gwede's turn to do the due diligence, he literally would turn a blind eye and say, but is he mining charter corner? And it was always his excuse when he was asked about the illegal mines and what to do with them. And he'd say, no, but just consult the mining charter. And he'd never do any enforcement as the minister. And this is a problem now that is coming from, you know, I was telling my students the other day that I'd rather have an overzealous minister who misses his shot, who gets it totally wrong, but at least pushes the needle in some kind of direction. I hate people like Gwede Mantashe with a passion because he doesn't shoot at all. He sits there, he scratches his beard and expects the world to spin, and he must somehow get money for it.
Sure.
It's mad. It's I don't know how we're going to get any closer to sorting this problem out. And in the meantime, just just by the information you've given us this morning, which most of it, I have to say, is new to us. And thank you for that, Leto. It's always good to catch up with you. But I mean, on this matter, you've opened up a Pandora's box of just horrific things that are happening that we didn't even realize. And I'm sure, because we have so many dodgy people in our comments section, some of them are going to be ferrying Nando's chickens to Velkom soon, trying to make their fortune.
If I drive into Velkom with like a buggy full of tins, is someone going to stop me and take them away?
Nobody's going to stop you, but you're going to have to go onto mine grounds. And that's another thing. A part of the mine grounds, basically, Sispumi, is also like a toxic wasteland. Remember that the mercury we were talking about earlier on, they used to process with mercury too. So there's a part of the mine that if you're driving through, you're basically just raising mercury that's mixed in with soil into your car. There are places in the mine where you could just... It could go under your feet. It could just be a sinkhole.
Okay.
There's chemical contamination, and through all of that, you could be taking the food to the wrong guy. You could take the chickens there. They give you your millions, and then you end up getting tortured in the township before you even get to the R32. So this. It's all unsavory. There's nothing about it that's good.
Dirk says in Australia.
You were the person to talk to.
No, you were so right. So Dirk says here, in Australia, when mines are closed down, all the tunnels are collapsed. The shafts are filled up with concrete or they're flooded and the area is rehabilitated. So you don't know there was anything there after a few years. We don't
Which
have that.
That's what's supposed to happen. That's what's supposed to happen. And the only way to rehabilitate a mine, by the way, is to turn it into a wetland. There's nothing else you can do to it. You can't build a mall on top of it. You can't give it for housing. It's to create some kind of wetland, the sort of marsh environment where birds can come and all of those. And you also have to get rid of that that water that's sort of methane-filled, sulfur-filled. Like, you should stand in Velkom on a cold winter night. It smells like rotten eggs throughout the whole town because of the sulfur water that's lying next to the slime dam. You have a whole town constructed. I was looking at it the other day. Remember, I think in the 80s, there was a slime dam burst in Virginia that almost wiped out the whole town of Virginia. And ever since then, slime dams are constructed in a certain way where, one, you find the slime dam here, and a road that's elevated so that the slime doesn't run as fast down towards the township. You'll find trees that are planted in front of it in three rows, and then another set of trees just planted in a sort of like a plantation style in rows. And all of that is to prevent the slime dam eventually bursting its seams and basically just killing everybody with hot sludge.
Jeez.
So you have to construct the town to mitigate the dangers of the mine. That's one of the funny things. You can't, there are places in Velkom where you can't have a borehole. So we petitioned the university, CUT, to have a borehole in case, because you know the water just sporadically switches off in Velkom. So we implored them to have a borehole. We dug the borehole so that the community can have access to water through the resources of the university, tested the water, and it's full of mercury.
Yes, sir.
So there are places where you can't even have a borehole when you are having mining operations. So, you know, you look at these things and they seem beneficial. In the long run, if there are lazy laws, if there are lazy ministers, if you have lazy legislators, 50 years later, people are suffering for their fuck up whenever that was. And I think that's the most heartbreaking thing.
And poor enforcement, it would seem.
Yeah. In Australia, like that guy said, in Australia, you have to rehabilitate. They will punish you. You have to rehabilitate. Here, it's a suggestion to rehabilitate. Because a rehabilitated mine is very, very good for the surrounds. There was a poorly rehabilitated mine here. There was methane buildup and it exploded. The lucky part is that the explosion was under an unpopulated area, but there was a huge crack in the ground because they were reckless in how they filled the mine with concrete. So there are very careful ways you need to do it. It's very methodical. It must be well planned out. Just like it was well planned out when you were trying to get the gold, it's the same process when you're trying to rehabilitate. And these investors and these mine bosses just don't give a damn at the end of the mine's life. And they just leave it as is and, you know, move to the next one. It's on to the next one. And then they'll come back after a couple of years and propose an ultra deep project, just like they did in Carletonville.
Sure.
Good heavens. All right. Well, I mean, this has been eye-opening, to say the least. And you've delivered, my friend. I'm sorry that we've been so quiet and we haven't spoken to you in such a long time, but yeah, you've come back with a punch. So, Leto Ntoba, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for informing all of us of the real story, because it gets lost, you know, and you see idiots who have no idea what they're talking about on social media throwing around ideas and condemning this group and that group and saying, well, this must happen to those ones and that must happen to the other one. It's not that simple. You've helped us to understand a whole lot more around this, and I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
Insane. Yeah, we love prosecuting the other because it's always nice, right? It's the whites, it's the foreigners, it's the blacks, it's the poor, it's these women, it's those women.
It's deplorable.
Yeah. Yes.
It's just this total lack of responsibility and personal accountability. So it's much easier to pass it on to someone and also to villainize somebody, you know? We lionize some and we villainize others because we live in this stupid, childish world where we think everything is one or the other.
Life is infinitely complex. Mm-hmm. And to deal with the complications, we have to be circumspect. We can't just want to see one bleed because the crowd is cheering. That's never the solution. And I think, as I always say, you know, it's depressing living in a town like this, but it also forces one to face their demons and pray to the better angels and try to appeal to the better nature of people, try to help where you can, and laugh where it's hopeless, you know? And that, I think, South Africa, we can learn a whole lot more from Velkom in that regard. Laugh at the stupid and help where you can.
Sure. Leto, thank you. Pumi, thank you. And that is our burning platform for this morning. I do want to give credit and tribute to our friend JJ Cornish, who of course has been part of Africa Analysis. We used to play that out after every burning platform on a Thursday. And for those of you who don't know, JJ Cornish died last Wednesday, and it was very sudden, but he died peacefully. And he was a great part of our lives here on the podcast party. He was a terrific purveyor of information about the continent, something which very, very few journalists were expert in. And we relied very heavily on his expertise to be able to understand the complex, diverse continent that we live on. I'm going to let you see a quick tribute that we recorded, and which was put together expertly by Jack Mutlante. And we will see you next week, Thursday morning, 7 a.m. Don't miss it for the Burning Platform. Prick Analysis, an edition I didn't really want to do, because we're paying tribute to the incredible Jean-Jacques Cornish, a remarkable journalist whose voice transcended borders and narratives. Jean-Jacques Cornish died on Wednesday, the 13th of November, and he's going to be very much missed by his family here at the podcast party. He was a veteran journalist. He graced the airwaves of South African radio and over here, podcasts, with his usual warm bonjour that he used to start with. His words not only informed us, but also created a sense of connection to, principally, the great continent of Africa. Having covered many international events, and he had personal connections to many of the protagonists in those events, Jean-Jacques quickly became a trusted Africa correspondent for many years. He further distinguished himself as the London Bureau Chief of the South African Press Association, and he had a special correspondent at the United Nations position from the age of just 25, a testament to his talent and his dedication. Now, beyond his professional accolades, what truly set Jean-Jacques Cornish apart was his ability to weave complex African stories with great interest, empathy, and clarity. He edited several newspapers, he championed narratives that often went unheard, and he inspired us all with his credibility and his great sense of humor. I'd also like to thank the Johannesburg Business School for their long-standing support of this feature of African Analysis and for supporting and backing the news that J.J. Cornish exposed us to from all over this continent. Today, we honor Jean-Jacques' legacy by continuing his spirit of curiosity and compassion. Thank you, Jean-Jacques, for your professionalism, your honesty, and for the many stories that you told. Your voice will echo in Africa forever. The podcast party's Africa Analysis, which is brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. And as always, we're joined by the repository of knowledge in human form, that is Jean-Jacques Cornish. JJ, how are you?
I'm immensely well, Gareth. I was fearful that I might have heard suppository there and it would have made my eyeballs pop.
No, definitely a repository of knowledge, not a suppository of knowledge. Although I think there are probably a few people who listen to African Analysis that feel like sometimes we give them a suppository of knowledge.
Either 50 way, years ago that I met Idi Amin at the very United Nations General Assembly, which is sitting down here now. I gate crashed his dinner. And walked up to him and told him that I have not been invited to your dinner, but I've decided I want to come here to meet you. He said to me, "Are you racist?" I said, "I don't believe I am, sir." Then he said, "You are welcome."
Wow.
Yeah. Gareth, over the years, I've been blessed to be covering Africa, alternating between hope and despair. And Madagascar is one of those places. The question so often asked is, where would you go? Where would you go spend your own money to go there? Or the other question is, where would you take your wife to? And Madagascar certainly must number right at the top. It's a remarkable country and absolutely amazing. I've been there several times as an election observer.
We thought it would be a good idea to find out from JJ what actually happens when you're an election observer. What that entails, how it comes about that he ended up being an election observer, and what he has observed. So straight over to the man who's found himself in 14 countries, JJ?
No fewer than 14 as an observer.
That's very impressive. I mean, that's a CV.
I absolutely love it. At least I'm counting now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of those I've been with this organization, and a very, very enviable organization it is too, called EISA, E-I-S-A, set up to observe our elections, our first democratic election in 1994. Electoral Institute for South Africa.
There's an interesting bit of travel advice from JJ Cornish this morning. You see, you get it all. You get a cornucopia of options on African Analysis here every week. We talk politics, we talk the state of nations, we talk elections, we talk all kinds of things. You even get travel advice from JJ Cornish. It's a pleasure to have you, JJ. Nice to see you again, and we will catch up in another couple of days.
I look forward to that. Cornucopia. And oh, by the way, Gareth, thank you so much for telling me the meaning of plethora.
Oh.
It means a lot, man.
Thank you very much.